Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Rhine, along with Paul Steinhauser. On Background is brought to you by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, representing the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for our most vulnerable citizens. This is the show that's all about the First the Nation presidential primary and the politics of the great state of New Hampshire. And as we hit April, springtime is upon us, and the field is starting to take shape. We're starting to get a sense for, you know, where this race is at. And really, the last week has been about an individual who is not running for president of the United States at this point in time, but everybody assumes will be running in the short term. And that is Joe Biden. His behavior over the course of his political career, one of which has always been very engaging, open, and, you know, quite honestly, affectionate with folks, whether it's hugging, touching shoulders, and things of that nature. Joe Biden has campaigned and engaged in a certain way for a long period of time. The voices became louder. Individuals coming forward, seven over the last week, have come forward to say that Joe Biden participated in behavior that they felt uncomfortable with. And as a result of that, Biden pushed forth a video on social media and said that he was going to be more mindful of his behavior moving forward. Paul, do you think that this is going to change things for Biden, or do you feel that this story is going to continue until he makes an announcement?
Yeah, it's going to the criticism is going to continue. There was no apology in his video. I thought the video actually was pretty good. It may have been a little couple days behind a schedule. Maybe he should have done it a little earlier in the controversy. But there is some criticism that he didn't. There was no apology in the video. So this is going to continue until he, you know, does a live interview and maybe until he eventually apologizes. My sources, though, close to the Biden inner circle are telling me that this isn't slowing down in any way, shape, or form, though, their march towards a likely announcement after Easter. That's what I'm being told. It'll probably be after Easter, maybe later this month or early in May. One source telling me, and you could see it on my Fox News story, that this has only resolved the vice president even more, this crisis over the last week. The first of his campaign that's not even a campaign yet. So will it slow down the push towards the inevitable launch? No. But more needs to be done by the vice president to set things straight. You know, this isn't sexual harassment. This isn't sexual assault. There are no allegations of that. It's inappropriate touching. But in this day and age, in the Me Too movement era, it's something that he's going to have to deal with. And nobody is surprised that this came up. Again, he's helped himself, but he needs to do a little bit more to get up from under this.
And one of the things that we have learned in the Me Too movement, and you know, I think a lot of people learned prior to the Me Too movement, is that just because you as an individual don't deem something as inappropriate, or just because you have the best intentions in doing it, doesn't make you the sole proprietor of what that behavior is. And I think that that's what was missing from the Biden video as well, which, as you referenced, I thought was good. I thought it was about 2 days late. But he, you know, still is in this kind of defining what his intentions were and what he's going to do moving forward. But when you touch other individuals, you know, they get a say as well as to whether they feel something is appropriate or inappropriate. And that's, you know, what you're referencing in regards to an apology, where obviously he felt one way about what he was doing and they felt another way. And that is something that needs to be acknowledged. I agree with you in regards to the TV interview side of things, sitting down with Leslie Stahl for 60 Minutes or Gayle King, Andrea Mitchell, Rachel Maddow.
Chris Rhine and Paul Steinhauser. Why are you shortchanging us?
If he could come in at any point in time, we can address this issue. I feel that there's still that needs to take place, but I don't think, as you mentioned in your reporting, this is not going to stop him from running for president. If it were me in the campaign, I might move things up even a little bit, so that you can, you know, kind of change the subject. And so the question is going to be, Can he change his behavior, though? He says he's going to be more mindful of it.
You know, as that was going on all week, the other big story, of course, was campaign cash. This was the end of the first quarter, so we finally got a chance to look at the numbers for some from some of the candidates. Why do we care about campaign cash? Because it's an important barometer, especially early in the presidential cycle, of a campaign strength, of a candidate's clout. And we got some interesting news. First of all, Bernie Sanders is doing extremely well. He raised over $18 million in the 70 days from when he launched his campaign in mid-February until the end of the quarter, which was the end of March. That's a lot of money, and it came from 900,000 individual contributions. So Sanders right now is the king of campaign cash when it comes to the race for the White House. Kamala Harris, senator from California, raised $12 million since she jumped into the campaign in late January. That's a good haul as well. And Beto O'Rourke raised $9.4 million. Not as much as the two of them, but he did that in only 18 days, which is also impressive as well. So those three, obviously, right now are the campaign kings when it comes to fundraising. But also, some other news this week that was interesting. The first candidate to reveal his numbers was Pete Buttigieg. Listen, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now, that he is a candidate on the rise. We've seen the larger crowds, and we've seen the media attention, the media blitz. Now we have some campaign numbers to back that up. $7 million for Buttigieg, which for somebody who just a couple of weeks ago was a nobody, a long shot to the, for the nomination, we couldn't even pronounce his last name. Now he's a legitimate contender. So that was the other big campaign story this week, Chris.
Yeah, he was, as you defined him, the longest of long shots in this race.
Other than Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson.
I would say that he was perhaps even a longer shot than those individuals. You know, based upon Marianne Williamson is well known from her years on Oprah. Andrew Yang, has...
Not on Oprah.
He wasn't on Oprah, but he has access to more capital personally than Buttigieg has, and to put out a best-selling book. Buttigieg was the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, so I would make the argument that he was perhaps the longest of long shots in this race. And now, if you look at the New Hampshire primary right now, we've been talking about this a lot this week on my show. Where if you had a final four of candidates as we sit right now, he's in my final four here in New Hampshire. I think that he would finish in the top four here in the Granite State if voting was held today. And that's obviously he's ascending in a way too, where it's not sustainable, where it's not like he is just blanketing everywhere and it's all everyone is talking about, period. He is steadily climbing up, and there are little signs here and there that he is doing well. There's not an oversaturation. Like, I feel like the Beto coverage and, you know, the way we've been talking about Biden for the last couple of days, there's an oversaturation, and people are kind of tired of that to some extent. But with Buttigieg, the stories are all really positive, and it's not like it's an oversaturation.
Yeah, you know, I talked to him last week. We had that interview right here on Background. And he said that the surge, the increase in exposure and the increase in crowd sizes, he really noticed it right here first in New Hampshire back on March 9th. He had a lot of positive reviews that morning, that Friday morning when he did Politics and Eggs, when he headlined the Politics and Eggs speaking series. And then he said he had an event in Portsmouth later that evening. He was expecting a smaller crowd, and he got a large crowd. He said from there it just exploded, especially after he did that CNN Town Hall 2 days later. So he's coming back this weekend, and here's an interesting thing. The Friday night event in Manchester was supposed to be a two-share brewery. Mm-hmm. Guess what? They've now changed that to the Courier Museum of Art. Why? Because the campaign needed a larger venue, because more people are showing up. So there's another sign there, and he also drew 1,000 people on Wednesday night at Northeastern University in Boston. So he's seeing the numbers. He's seeing the crowds. He's not the only candidate here this weekend. We've also got Kirsten Gillibrand making the rounds across the state, the senator from New York. But wait, there's more. Cory Booker coming back to the state as well, the senator from New Jersey. And we've also got two potential candidates. No, they're not potential. They're going to be running. And that's Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado. He's coming back. And he's coming back even though he was just diagnosed the other day with prostate cancer. But he's still coming back and doing this. His campaign says they expect him to get a clean bill of health in the coming weeks. And after that, they would expect that he would be jumping into the White House race. When he was last year, he told me he was inclined to run for the presidency. And then Eric Swalwell back, the congressman from California, from the East Bay area. He's coming back twice this month. And his campaign telling me that an announcement should be coming probably before the calendar hits May.
An announcement has taken place for Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio. He is running for president of the United States. He's going to be back here next week, so good to see him into the contest. Next segment of the program, Paul talks with Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman who's running for president, and Laura Trump, the daughter-in-law of President Trump, who is helping his efforts in re-election. Back with more on Background after this.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, not getting a lot of media attention over the last couple months, but an interesting person as she runs for the Democratic presidential nomination. Second youngest candidate. She's 37 years old. Only Pete Buttigieg is younger. The first Hindu in Congress. She would be the first Hindu American to make it to the White House if she wins the presidential election. Also an Iraq war vet. So a lot of interesting stuff going on with her. She was in Concord recently, and I had a chance to talk to her about some of the top issues on the campaign trail.
Let's start with the Electoral College, because an increasing number of Democrats running for the White House say, let's maybe scrap it. What do you think?
There are reforms that need to take place to make it so that our votes are being cast and counted and represented in the outcome of our elections. I think there are pros and cons to the existing Electoral College and to getting rid of it. What I think would be important is for us to have a conversation about how we can best move forward. I think it's unfortunate that too often these calls for changes come about by the side that has lost or suffered as a result of the Electoral College. So I think it's important for us as a country to have a conversation about what is the best way forward to make sure that this process is fair and representative of the people who are voting in our democracy.
Another one that's come up is the filibuster. And we're seeing an increasing number of Democrats running for the White House say, yeah, maybe it's time for it to go. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's another one that is important for us to look at how we solve this or make changes that are not based on partisanship. Often it is the party that is in the minority that is calling for bringing about those changes. And then once they get into the majority, then they say, no, absolutely not. We're not going to change this. So this is a conversation I think that's important for the American people to have to see what kind of changes we want to see take place.
One more that's come up, reparations for slave reparations for those descendants. What do you think about those?
I've actually co-sponsored a bill, H.R. 40, in the House of Representatives that would put together a commission to look at the damage that has occurred because of our country's dark history with slavery, and to figure out what is the best way to bring about those reparations. I think we need to bring about reparations. It's really a question of what is the right way and how.
This is Bernie Sanders' country. He won big here in the primary back in 2016. He's now in the race, and I'm wondering, what is your pitch to Bernie Sanders supporters here for them to not go with the original but to come to you?
This is about something much bigger than just one person, and so my pitch to the people here in New Hampshire and to people across the country is about what I bring to the table as I'm offering to serve as president and commander-in-chief. My experience serving as a soldier in the Army National Guard now for nearly 15 years, serving on two deployments to the Middle East and in Congress for over 6 years on both the Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committees, give me this personal experience, depth and understanding about the issues that we face and why we must end these wasteful regime change wars and nuclear arms race to bring those trillions of dollars back to serving the needs of the people and communities like ours here in New Hampshire and across the country.
And finally, Sanders is 77. Joe Biden, the former vice president, about to get in. He's 76 years old. Are they too old to be the nominee? Should the nominee go to somebody of a younger generation?
I think the nominee should go to Tulsi Gabbard. This is about qualifications, and this is about who can best serve the people of this country. I'm running for president because I bring this unique experience and understanding that will change our priorities in this country, that will change our foreign policy, and make it so that we can meet the needs of our people, so that we can change our domestic policies that are actually serving the interests of the people and our country and our planet.
And finally, can you you're right on the bubble, I guess, on the debate stage. Do you think the DNC's requirements to get on the debate stage, the 1% in the polls, the factors of how many people have signed up for the campaign, is that fair?
I think it is. I think they've opened it up to a grassroots approach and leaving it up more to determine it to being determined by the people rather than just by a few people sitting in the DNC building in Washington. I'm really grateful to see the kind of support that has built up around our campaign, and I look forward to being able to, because of the voices and involvement of the people, make that qualification and get on the debate stage.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Tulsi Gabbard right there, the congresswoman from Hawaii and a Democratic presidential contender. Also in the Granite State this past week, we had Laura Trump. She's not running for president. No, she's the daughter-in-law of the president. She's married to Eric Trump. She's also a top spokesperson for the Trump re-election campaign, and she was here to headline the New Hampshire Republican Party's main fundraising gala, the Spring to Victory dinner, which was held this year down in Nashua. I had a chance to sit down with her and talk about a bunch of issues. We started with the campaign cash numbers that we were seeing this week.
Well, first of all, you're up here representing the campaign.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the campaign cash numbers we've seen. Today, I was just wrote a story for Fox News. Bernie Sanders, $18 million. Pete Buttigieg, nobody, $7 million. What are you making of those numbers on the Democratic side?
Well, I think for the most part, those numbers are from very large donors. One or two people with a lot of money who are, you know, financing these campaigns and really want to give these people a leg up. At our campaign, at the Trump campaign, we're very proud of the fact that the vast majority, 96% of the money that we raise comes from low-dollar donors, meaning $100 or less. And we've surpassed almost every fundraising expectation. We've broken records between the campaign, between the RNC. So we're not worried about that in any sense. But listen, people I know on the Democrat side, they're looking for vengeance. Their candidate did not win in 2016, so they're going to bankroll all of these other campaigns. I'm sure they're looking to give anybody a leg up that they can. I don't think it's going to have that much effect. You know, first of all, they have to fight out in the primaries, which get your popcorn ready because I think it's going to be a show. So we'll let them take care of spending that money up front, and we'll worry about whoever the challenger is later.
I think the Trump campaign and all the committees together raised a good amount in the last quarter of last year, $6.9 million.
Yes.
Any idea when we'll see the numbers for the first quarter of this year from the campaign?
They should be coming out very soon. I know that we just reported them in the past day or two, so they should be coming out very soon.
And do you think, are they comparable to?
They're better. They're much better than the last quarter of last year.
Okay. See, I was looking for that little hint there. So.
Yeah.
Here in New Hampshire, we've had a guy called Bill Weld up here a lot lately.
Yes.
Tell me about the Trump campaign. Is Bill Weld and maybe even a John Kasich or somebody else, Larry Hogan, on the campaign's radar? Are you concerned about the possibility of, you know, dealing with a primary challenge?
Well, this has been a question since really the president was elected. And what are we going to do if another Republican challenges him? First of all, I don't know why someone would be dumb enough to challenge Donald Trump. First, this is a man who had just made several promises on the campaign trail in 2016, has delivered on not only those promises, but so much more, produced results for the people of this country. The RNC has already said that their candidate in 2020 is going to be Donald Trump. So I don't know why anyone would waste their time or money, quite frankly, on the Republican end, trying to challenge the president. We're not worried about that at all. I think kind of they're wasting their time. Maybe they should wait till 24 when they actually have a shot at something.
Is there a game plan, though, or a strategy, you know, if Well decides to do it, if Kasich or somebody else decides to do it, is there a strategy and kind of a pushback ready by the campaign and by the RNC?
I mean, I think the pushback is going to come directly from the president, and I think he's going to be very clear that these are people that are just out to get him personally. They clearly don't want what's best for the country, because the country, if you look at it as a whole, is doing so much better under a Trump presidency since Donald Trump was inaugurated. You look at the highest stock markets in the history of this country, the lowest unemployment, the jobs pouring back in this country, the manufacturing jobs that our previous president said you'd have to have a magic wand to bring back are now flowing back in by the hundreds of thousands. People as a whole are doing better in this country. So why anyone would want to change that or challenge that, I think we'll let him deal with that directly, and I think we all know he will. But again, I just think maybe these are people that are looking for some publicity or something on their own. We don't really worry about it too much.
This state right here was the first one to give Donald Trump a win.
Yes.
And it boosted him to the nomination in the White House. He narrowly lost the state in the general election. We've only seen him here once since he won back in 2016. And I'm wondering, now that we're into the 2020 cycle, a lot of Republicans here are wondering, how much are we going to see the president up here?
Oh, you'll see him. Don't worry. We're going to get him up here in short order. We obviously were so upset to lose by less than 3,000 votes in 2016. The good news is that on the ground here in New Hampshire, we've identified thousands of people that did not vote for the president in 2016 who are Trump supporters now, who are excited to get out and vote for him in 2020. So we feel very confident about winning here in New Hampshire in 2020. And that is the whole goal. He'll be here many times. I mean, you guys know you're ground zero for all. You've had almost all the candidates here on the Democrat side so far. I know I'm the first Trump to come here in this election cycle. I won't be the last. You'll see the president. You'll see so much more from the campaign and from the White House, I'm sure. But we're all excited. We this is a very special state. Like you said, we won our first primary here. This was just a really exciting place for us, and we're excited to get back, and we're excited to win it.
Finally, also speaking tonight is the governor, very popular Republican governor here, Chris Sununu. Any thoughts from you and the campaign on whether he should run for re-election as governor, or should he maybe take on Gene Shaheen for the Senate?
Oh, well, he's done such a great job as governor. Mm-hmm. This state has the lowest unemployment in the entire country. I mean, this is, it's historic what's going on here. We think he's doing a great job. Obviously, we'd support him no matter what he wants to do. But I like what he's done so far as governor. So I would almost encourage him not to leave that position.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Great.
That is Laura Trump, the daughter-in-law of President Trump. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Gene Shaheen is next. I spoke with U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen earlier this week about three healthcare bills that she is rolling out to deal with affordability issues in regards to the Affordable Care Act, and also her feelings about the accusations against Joe Biden and the Mueller report. Here's my conversation with Gene Shaheen. Senator Gene Shaheen is joining us to discuss a major announcement in regards to healthcare affordability. She's pushing forth a package which includes three bills. She's going to join us right now on the program to discuss. Senator Shaheen, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Chris.
First, talk a little about the impetus behind this. You've been hearing, obviously, for years from individuals about health care and about the cost of health care. What drove you to push forth this legislation?
Well, we heard last week that the Trump administration has ordered the Justice Department to weigh in on the side of, in the Texas lawsuit, of totally unraveling the Affordable Care Act. So not just getting rid of the individual mandate, not just getting rid of the pre-existing conditions provisions, but all of it. And so what I think we need to do is to not unravel the Affordable Care Act. We need to address the concerns that people have expressed with it, but we need to do it in a way that makes sure that people can continue to get access to health care.
The first bill is Improving Health Insurance Affordability Act. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a bill to try and help those people who have been priced out of the health care market, and what it would do is increase the value of tax credits for those who are currently eligible for federal assistance. That's worked very well in the startup of the Affordable Care Act and helping people afford the premiums, and it would expand the eligibility for those premium tax credits for more middle-income families.
The second is the Marketplace Certainty Act.
Yes, that reduces deductibles and copays for low-income and middle-income families. It expands the cost-sharing reduction assistance. If you remember, one of the first things the Trump administration did 2 years ago after the repeal of the Affordable Care Act was to get rid of those payments that went to the health insurance companies to help people afford the cost of health insurance. This would address that.
The third bill is Reducing Costs for Out-of-Network Services Act. What does that entail?
Well, one of the things that people have expressed real concerns about is going to the doctor, having procedures done in the hospital, and then discovering that their health insurance didn't pay for that. So they get huge bills. And so what this would do is to cap how much hospitals and physicians could charge for people who are provided out-of-network services. So if you have to go out of your health care network that's provided by your health insurance company, it would cap the amount of money you would have to pay out of pocket.
In terms of the prescription drugs, this has been a obviously a big issue and an issue that you've talked about a lot. Was there thought to including that as a separate piece of legislation, or do you feel that prescription drug costs will be helped by the this any of this legislation?
Well, I think prescription drug costs have to be addressed separately, and we need to do that. We know that that's one of the biggest drivers of healthcare costs. That means healthcare costs are increasing. I was up at a hospital a couple of weeks ago, and I heard from folks that they had a doctor had provided a prescription for a patient. He went to the pharmacy to get it filled, and the cost was $4,000. He obviously wasn't able to pay that. And we've got to do something about those huge prescription drug costs that people are facing, particularly older Americans. You know, the when we added Part D to Medicare to help cover the cost of prescription drugs, we left a hole in when people could get coverage for prescription drugs. And what we're seeing with the effort by this administration to undermine the Affordable Care Act is instead of closing that donut hole for prescription drug costs, it's increasing again. So we've got to do something about that. There are three ways we could do it pretty easily. One is to address the patent protections that brand pharmaceutical companies are given for brand name drugs. They've learned how to game that system in a way that allows them to continue to charge for brand name drugs. We need to allow the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to negotiate with drug companies for the costs of prescription drugs. The VA can do that, and if you're a veteran and you go to the VA to get your prescription drugs, those are much lower cost than what people are getting through Medicare. And the third way is to allow importation, reimportation of drugs from Canada and from other countries. We know that people in New Hampshire are going up to Canada to buy prescription drugs because it's so much cheaper.
That's U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. This hour of the program presented by New England College, as well as Riverbend Community Mental Health. In this segment brought to you by Suncook Dental, we're talking about the three bills she is introducing aimed at tackling problems with in regards to health care, improving Health Insurance Affordability Act, as well as the Marketplace Certainty Act, and the Reducing Costs for Out-of-Network Services Act. In regards to paying for this legislation, the first bill in regards to health insurance affordability works off of tax credits. Is there a feeling, though, in regards to what the overall cost of this legislation would be?
Well, you know, Chris, the whole cost debate in healthcare does not take into account the long-term cost of not providing health insurance for people. If people are forced to go to the emergency room for their health care, that is the most expensive, least efficient way to provide health care. If people delay getting checkups so they are very ill when they finally go to the doctor, that increases health care costs. It's in everyone's interest to make sure people can get health care when they need it, that they have health insurance so that they don't feel like they can't go to the doctor. And in the long term, that's going to save the system money, not cost.
And final thing on this, and I have a couple more questions. In regards to the Out-of-Network Services Act, this is puts in a price cap on what can be charged to individuals by hospitals and physicians who either have individual coverage or are uninsured. Is there a feeling as to where you're going to place that that cap?
Well, we're still having that conversation now. We had a cap, and when we introduced it in the last session of Congress, there were some concerns expressed about it, so we're continuing to talk about that.
And do you see that as being that of the three bills, the one that's going to be the most difficult to achieve? And what sense do you get in regards to bipartisan agreement in regards to this legislation? Do you see a path forward?
You know, Chris, it's really disappointing to me that at a time when we could be working together to address healthcare costs, to address the coverage that people are able to get, that what we've seen from the Trump administration, from our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, is an unwillingness to work together to do anything to address the challenges that people are facing with health care.
Moving on to a couple different topics, a poll this weekend indicated that only 29% of Americans believe that Attorney General Barr's letter exonerates the president in any way. What are your feelings about where this is heading? Do you feel that you have been able to draw any conclusions at all based upon the Attorney General's summary?
Well, I think we really need to see the full report. It's been 2 years in the making. We got a four-page summary of what I understand is an over 300-page report. So I think we need to see that. The American people deserve to see it. And the Attorney General has said that he's going to provide the report in the next couple of weeks. What we don't know is how much of it will be redacted or covered up so that people can't see it.
Do you feel that Congress should receive the report in its entirety without any redactions?
I do, absolutely. Unless there is something that would endanger someone's life because it's classified information. You know, we know conclusively that Russia interfered in our election. We know that Special Counselor Mueller has brought nearly 200 charges against 34 individuals and three companies, including six former Trump officials, 26 Russian nationals. We know that President Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, is going to jail. We know his deputy campaign manager pleaded guilty. We know that one of his closest advisors, Roger Stone, has been indicted and is going to be tried. So there is no doubt that there was wrongdoing in the run-up to the election in 2016. So I think we need to see all of the information, and the public needs to see it so they can draw their own conclusions.
Joe Biden is in the news today as Lucy Flores, who is a lieutenant governor candidate in Nevada, pushed forth some credible accusations in regards to the vice president. Are you concerned in regards to those allegations and also the vice president's past behavior?
Well, I think I'm not concerned with regards to the vice president's past behavior in terms of what I've seen from the vice president and what I've heard from people and seen in New Hampshire. Now, I don't know about this particular incident. The vice president has said he didn't do anything improper. She has said he did. So sometimes it's hard to sort out what has happened.
A final thing, you were fundraising this past weekend off of a potential matchup with Chris Sununu in running for the United States Senate. Is it your anticipation that he will run for Senate?
Well, he's going to have to decide that for himself. But what we want to let people know is what the challenges are that we're facing in this campaign, and hope that people will be supportive.
As always, appreciate you joining us for the program.
It's always nice to be with you, Chris.
That is Gene Shaheen. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Spoke with Corey Lewandowski earlier this week, who, of course, was Donald Trump's campaign manager for the majority of Trump's presidential campaign. We discussed campaign politics ahead of the New Hampshire primary in the 2020 presidential election. How do you build a party that is both pro-Trump, who is, you know, even divisive within the Republican Party, as we see from Dupree, a close friend of John McCain's. How do you build a party around him, but also be inclusive? Because as you know, in order to raise money, you want to have as many individuals as possible who are involved in it, but you also want to make sure that there is a rank and file and order, and the president is the leader of the Republican Party at this point.
Well, there's no question the president is the leader of the Republican Party. The National Committee has already endorsed the president's reelection campaign. It's the singular focus at the Republican National Committee in Washington, D.C. I know Steve Dupree well. I have enormous respect for Steve. And what Steve knows is that the policies that this president has put in place have helped everyday Americans. They've helped everyday New Hampshire residents, whether it is the tax cuts policy, whether it is job creation, whether it is helping with creating manufacturing jobs, business tax cuts, individual tax cuts. These are all things that have helped our economy grow, and we're growing as a country at record proportions. We've got the lowest unemployment rate for African Americans and Hispanic Americans ever recorded because of the Trump policies, and everybody gets behind that. And that also gives people more opportunities as they're coming out of college to first pay off that college debt and second find real jobs because, you know, look, under the Obama administration, the growth rate, the new normal was 1.4, 1.5%. We've seen under the Trump administration threes and fours put up on the board. We're at a 3.8% unemployment, which is basically full unemployment. So you can sometimes disagree with the way the president delivers his message, whether you don't like his Twitter account or you think he's too harsh or he's too verbose, whatever it may be, you know, that's up for you to decide. But you cannot disagree with what he's done on behalf of the American people, the promises he's made and the promises he's kept. And that's why the Republican Party is stronger now than ever.
That right there is the message for 2020, and I think that's clear. The economic conditions, being a nation at relative peace, if those things hold up, I think that individuals are going to take stock of their own lives and make the determination as to, you know, where America is at. And they may not like, as I do not, the things that that Donald Trump has said about John McCain. You may not like the tone and the tenor, but there's also that acknowledgement and understanding, as you've said in the past, of letting Trump be Trump. And it works for him. It has worked for him in the past. It may not be the way that you'd like to see a president carry himself, but I think that you're totally right. And the message has to be, for Trump to have success, the big picture. And what is the big picture at this point in time? Because even no matter who the Democrats nominate, the focus of the next election is going to be on Donald Trump. He wants the focus to be on him. It's going to be on him. So there's going to be a need to, you know, to tell the story of what's happening in the nation and say, well, the job that I've done as president, the way that your life is right now, is better as a result of me being president. So, you know, look past the aspects that you may not like in regards to this presidency and take stock of where your life is and where you think the country is headed.
You're exactly right. Look, you can go back to what George Stephanopoulos and James Carville said, right? Is the economy stupid? And on top of that, yeah, a very simple question, is your life better today than it was 4 years ago? And by every economic indicator, the answer is yes. Look, this president has agreed to remove our troops from Syria. He has moved the embassy in Israel. He's recognized Israel's rights to the Golan Heights. He has done more for Israel than any president in our nation's history. He's cut more government regulations than any president he's cut more regulations in the first 2.5 years than any president has in 8 years. He made a pledge for every one new government regulation, he'd get rid of two. Well, he's getting rid of 22, which means less government burden on small business owners, taxpayers, and big businesses. And so, look, you can disagree again with his Twitter feed and say, you know, that's not presidential and maybe he should do it differently. But he's also been under this intense barrage of media scrutiny with a complete hoax about a Russia collusion narrative that has hung over this administration for 2 years. Bob Mueller spent 1 year, 10 months, and 6 days investigating this president with 12 Democrats. Attorneys, they could not find one piece of collusion, not one piece of obstruction. And so he's had to use a microphone to cut through the fake narrative that's appeared on some of the cable news networks. And it's tough, but I think the American people like a fighter. And when you look back and say, am I better off today? Do I have a better job? Do I have more opportunity? Whether I'm a college student, I'm a mid-career person, or I'm at the end of my career, is my 401 account better today than it was when the president came in? You bet it is. And so that's how people vote. They vote with their pocketbook. And look, they may not like the way he says certain things, but I think they respect the results that he's been able to achieve in the short 2.5 years he's been there.
I want to touch on the Democratic field a little with you before we let you go. Is there anybody out there right now that you look at and say, this is an individual who is a problematic matchup for Donald Trump?
Well, look, I think that the individuals that would be most problematic for Donald Trump will never make it through the Democratic primary. Now, a guy who has gotten a lot of attention, who's a very much an unknown, is Pete Buttigieg,
yeah,
I think his name is.
Buttigieg,
the mayor, Buttigieg, yeah.
It took me, Corey, it took me 2 weeks to figure out how to say his name correctly. So once I nailed it, I'm going to say it. I'm going to correct people every single time.
you should, because I'll tell you what. Look, the guy's raised a ton of money.
Yeah, $7 million,
as the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, which, by the way, to put it in perspective, South Bend has about 100,000 people. It's about the size of the city of Manchester.
Yeah.
And this guy has raised a commensurate amount with Kamala Harris. Not like she outraised him,
yeah.
But this guy's done a great job. Yeah. And he's the type of individual that if I were a Democrat consultant, I would not be looking at the Elizabeth Warrens of the world and the Bernie Sanders and the Robert Francis O'Rourke. I'd be looking at a moderate who can win in places that they lost last time. I know Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia, is thinking about entering the race. And look what they've done to Joe Biden in the last 72 hours. I mean, they destroyed Uncle Joe. And that's all come from the Democrats because they don't want him in the race.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the types of candidates that I think will be the most problematic if they could make it through the Democratic primary. But I think what you'll find, very similar to 1984 when Ronald Reagan ran for re-election, they nominated the far leftists, the socialists, as far as they could go. And it really took the Democratic Party a long time to recover from that election loss in 84. I think what's going to happen is a far leftist is going to get the nomination. It is going to be a socialist who does not agree with or comport with the values of New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio. And if you can't win in those places, there is no path to victory just carrying New York and California.
I completely agree with you. I think that, you know, kind of bring it back full circle to what we were talking about in regards to the economy. If this becomes a Donald Trump debating the virtues of capitalism versus Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris or someone else debating the virtues of socialism, that's going to be a problem for Democrats. I think this is a very winnable election for Democrats if they nominate the right person. And you know, Pete Buttigieg is a individual who I think could do very well in a general election. Again, it's a very big jump. There's no clear line that exists between the mayor's office in South Bend, Indiana, and the White House. But what he has is he is a very strong communicator. He is extremely comfortable in his own skin with who he is. He is authentic. And he is also a center-left politician. And that is what the Democratic Party should be looking for at this point in time. You want somebody that can do the job, that is clearly able to communicate, but someone that is not looking to change and alter what America is. And if that is the debate, socialism versus capitalism, and Republicans are clearly able to push that forward, a very winnable election becomes very problematic for Democrats.
It really does. And you have to win in those blue-collar places that the Democrats used to dominate, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. You know, Trump won in those places because of a message of bringing back trade jobs and bringing back the way that people remembered their fathers and grandfathers working on the assembly lines and having good-paying jobs, whether it was at a steel plant, a coal miner, or the automobile manufacturing, right? If your answer now is, hey, it's socialism, everything is free, and the Green New Deal, which means no cars, no airplanes, and no cows, is what the Democrats are embracing, there is no mathematical formula that will allow them to get to the 270 electoral votes. And you couple that, candidly, with the work that the president has done on prison reform and the support that he's receiving now in the African-American community. I know it doesn't sound like a lot. He got 6% of the African-American vote in the last election. If he ends up getting 10% of the African-American vote in this upcoming election, that all but assures him another victory in Michigan and Pennsylvania, because the suburbs of both Detroit and Philadelphia, respectively. And again, there's no path forward. So the Democrats have to find somebody, in my opinion, if they want to be successful, who's a moderate that can play in those places. If they just want to have a statement, which is socialism wins, then they will be outside the White House for another 4 years.
Corey, appreciate you joining us for the program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That is Corey Lewandowski. You've been listening On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, representing the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for the state's most vulnerable citizens.